This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV.
Welcome back. This is Now with Dave Brown on AMI Audio and AMI TV. I'm Mike Ross, filling in for Dave, who has the day off. Dave will be back on Monday. It is our weekly news panel here on Now. I've got Michelle McQuigg with us from the Canadian Press and Megan Gilmore, our accessibility reporter here at AMI and freelance journalist. And time for our next topic. A sharp increase in eating disorder cases is overwhelming Ontario hospitals. Admissions for eating disorders at the province's five pediatric hospitals jumped to as much as 223% above capacity in the month of June, as teens have struggled with isolation, a lack of routine, the loss of extracurricular activities, and negative social media influences. Megan, this story has got your attention and has you thinking about the impact of the pandemic on young people.
Right. I think young people are a segment of the population who are going to be considerably impacted by this pandemic. I've just been thinking a lot about the experiences I had as a teenager, and most of them involved large groups of people and doing things with groups of people, sometimes going places, in some cases going, like traveling overseas, or even just babysitting, you know, the simple, more routine things like that. All that's been taken away. And those formative years where you're forming your identity, where you're getting job skills, where you're learning what independence looks like and how to use it, that's been dramatically altered for an entire generation. And we're going to be seeing the impacts of that for a long time to come. And then you have these stories coming out about the spiking eating disorders. And this has been a concern for many people for months, studying this. And it's also another reminder of the many other mental health challenges and health challenges that have been exacerbated by the pandemic and have always been there. And now we need to take a look at this again. I grew up in the time where it was fairly common to hear about eating disorders discussed, even in like books for young adults. It was sometimes a plot point that would come up to teach you what an eating disorder was. I don't know how much we still do that, and now's our chance.
Michelle, what's your impression of how youth have been impacted in this pandemic?
I think it is an area that we've touched on really broad strokes, that people, I think, understand theoretically that teens have had a lot to bear through this, but not necessarily explored the specific fallout. So, Megan, I'm so glad you raised this topic, because I find it the numbers in the article that you sent all of us on the panel that everyone should probably take a look at in the Globe and Mail are really alarming, for one thing. And another deeply disturbing aspect is that simply due to lack of capacity, people who are working with teens to try and address their eating disorders are having to abandon evidence-based practices in treatment because they don't have the capacity to do this. So a lot of wisdom has suggested theoretically that teens should not have to eat their meals in their beds because it's easier to conceal food that way. But they're having to do that because there's not enough space. Mm-hmm. There's a discouraging effort to have teens who have eating disorders share rooms together for fear that there may be some reinforcement going on or you know, discussions around bucking treatment or whatnot. That's now happening, again, entirely due to lack of capacity. So in an era when we've been hearing a lot about the importance of evidence-based decision-making, we're having to see a whole other set of health professionals abandon the science due to lack of resources. So that's all incredibly concerning, of course, on individual cases, but I do really worry about the teens and what they're going through, not just because of the lack of experiences that they're taking in, as Megan pointed out, but because of the ones they are taking in. I can only imagine if I had been a teen living through a global pandemic in relative isolation, that is an experience in and of itself, probably a pretty formative one, and I would struggle to see that as being a positive one. So when you have additional health concerns that are rapidly escalating into the mix, it's really concerning. And there's been a lot of discussion around kids, seniors, even Canadians with disabilities to a certain degree, not teens quite as much or in as much detail. And I think that has a lot of repercussions, of course, down the road, because that's the next generation.
I think that my experience growing up, of course, I mean, I grew up in a time that there was no social media, there were no cell phones, there were no smartphones. Video games were basically just starting out. And I think it's really easy for people of my age, you know, like 40 and up, to look at youth today and say, you know, well, in my day, we used to play outside and we weren't stuck looking at a screen all day. But I think it's a fair point when you then think about how differently kids now, how differently their brains are wired because of the amount of technology that's involved in their lives. Mm-hmm. Like kids, I'm someone who has been in education as a teacher. I coach youth sports and have for 30 years. And the one thing I can tell you is kids now are more visual learners than they've ever been. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that as the person who's doing the coaching, I've had to adapt as well. I've had to develop those teaching skills using the tools that they need in order to capture the message that I'm giving them. I've got to learn how to use those tools to teach them. And I can't help but think that because of that, the way their brains are wired now, that if this pandemic had happened, you know, in 1983, I think you'd have a different outcome for a lot of youth, because I can remember spending a lot of time alone as a kid, not having a lot of kids living on my street and just finding things to do to keep myself busy, because I wasn't, the screen was not part of my attachment to the world. And now when you have kids who spend so much time communicating with each other through screens, and less of the school really tends to be their number one source of daily interaction with people of their own age, suddenly that was taken away from them. And I don't think they're built. They are not built for that type of loneliness and that type of solitude because of the way they're now wired. I just think it's such a different world. And, you know, it's never a good time for a pandemic, but from a mental health standpoint for youth, it couldn't have happened at a worse time.
Interesting perspective about the wiring of the brain. I hadn't thought about that, but I think that's a really, really interesting point. And part of the ways in which this demographic is not necessarily as understood as it can or should be.
Megan?
Yeah, it is. It's an excellent point. And many people have been raising the concerns about how increased reliance on internet has rewired everybody's brains. But it's especially profound for those who have never known another way of communicating. Like, mm-hmm. I remember clearly the day our family got the internet. It was actually September 11th, 2001, incidentally. But, so there was a clear demarcation in my life: pre-internet, post-internet, pre-social media, post-social media, pre-smartphone, post-smartphone. Like, I know all that. But my niece and my nephews don't. They have... This is just all they've been handed. And I don't know if we've always done a good job as a society, as the older adults in the room, teaching them what is real online, what is not real, what is a good way to interact. And now you have the whole realm of the social media influencer. And there's always been online communities that have encouraged eating disorders and that type of behavior. But now I wouldn't be surprised if it's been taken to a whole new level. And how do we teach children literacy and what is true and what is not true, what is good and what is harmful.
Let me wrap this up with a question for the two of you. And that is asking about, because some of this, this pressure on kids and some of the cause of eating disorders is that so those social norms and those social pressures about body image, right? And you know, you're expected through advertising, through movies, through TV to look a certain way. And I can remember, so you guys know that I'm sort of dabbling in acting right now. And when I was first told, hey, you know what, you should try this, my initial reaction was, no, I don't look like Brad Pitt. There's nothing, you know, I'm not interested. Thank you very much. And I was told, no, there are roles for you. And it just didn't compute with me. And when I started doing it, I then had sort of this mini epiphany, I guess, in the way I watch television, and suddenly started realizing, oh yeah, there are like regular people, like everyday people like me on TV having to play the roles of those, you know, regular people. The subway driver, the school janitor, those are regular people. Brad Pitt does not play a subway driver. Well, unless it's like he's foiling some kind of international terrorist plot, then he probably could be.
Yeah, he and Liam Neeson are getting on Subway movie.
But the fact was, I didn't think of myself and the way I look as something that should be on screen. For some reason, AMI did. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. And other people have since. I did not think of myself as screen worthy, if you will. So I'm not immune to it, but I'm curious about the two of you and whether or not having a disability, living with a disability, has influenced or impacted you and how you portray or feel your body image is portrayed or how you feel about it. Michelle?
Oh, my. Well, full disclosure, body image is an issue with which I've had a very complex relationship. And my disability has, while you think it might shield me from some aspects, I would say it has not. In this case, the societal norms are so ubiquitous that I internalized a lot of it. I still would struggle when anyone deemed me to be socially or physically acceptable in any way. There was always that time of, no, you can't meet me, you must be meeting somebody else. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I couldn't see myself, while one might think theoretically that that would mean, oh well, that I'm immune to all the messaging and I'm not constantly comparing myself, it also means I have no frame of reference. Mm-hmm. So I have open questions that I can't resolve, and I might know that I'm out of step with society's ideals, because I am, but I would always be wondering how much, and it's entirely, I imagine it's possible that I might have overblown it, but probably not. And I don't have the means of relying on my own senses for confirmation one way or the other. And not knowing, at least for me, just begets more questions and keeps the cycle going in a way that isn't always wonderful.
Megan?
One of the reasons why I want to bring this topic to the table is in case there are parents or teachers listening today who you have a young person in your life with a disability who's going through puberty, because body image is really hard when you have a body that is somewhat different. So for me, I'm trying to think even just a few concrete examples. The concept of eye makeup, that you would make your eyes something beautiful, like that was confusing to me, because I'm like, the eye is not a beautiful thing. It is the thing that the doctor sticks drops in and we test it. Like it's not something that you would make desirable. It's very medical, even though I've been told my eyes are a very nice color. Like that concept, if somebody said, Megan, you have nice eyes, I never knew what that meant. Because I was like, they're not nice. They go to the doctor. Like, what are you talking about there? And then I know my parents may not have heard this story before, but I'm a fairly petite person. I wore size 0 jeans until I was 21 or 22. And then I had to wear size 4 and like almost had an emotional breakdown in the change room of my mother very deftly handled that situation while also probably trying to figure out, like, why is my kid so upset at size four? Like, that's fine. But when I was 12 or 13, I was super confused because I would bump into things all the time or fairly regularly. So I was like, well, am I fat? Like, can I not, like, get through the aisle at school where the desks are? And it wasn't that at all. It was just a pure hand-eye coordination orientation thing that was thrown off because of not being able to see things as well. But it was really, it was confusing. I was like, I don't understand how this works. To this day, shopping for clothes is, I treat it as a business and I will only take certain people with me. And it is a mission. And if you are not there to be on task, you will not come. This is not fun. This is not enjoyable. We're here to get what we need. You need to give brutally honest advice. And then we need to leave. It still stresses me out. And I've managed it now and I know who I go with. But like Michelle said, there is this tension of you don't know what the standard is. And sometimes people don't think to actually explain it to you because they might not even know it's actually something that you care about too.
Yeah.
Or if they do, they explain it in an extra prescriptive way. Because you do get lots of feedback about the standard from all kinds of places, but you can't really reach your own conclusions without mm-hmm. the full input of all your senses. At least I can't. Some people are, I'm almost certain, more enlightened than I am, and I've been able to get there. It's something I struggle with every day.
I thank you both very much for broaching the subject with me. And we've got a few minutes left on the other side of the break to talk about our final topic, and that is the return of Canadian sports fans to sporting events, live and in person. I want to get your impressions of that. And I know that one of us is going to be going to see some Toronto Blue Jays game or games soon enough. We'll get to that when we come back to the news panel here on AMI.
You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.